Would you please stand as you are able and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Please be seated. My name is Ty Parsons. I'm the director of the Northwest Missouri Regional Council of Governments. We're a five-county regional planning agency here in Northwest Missouri. And we are honored to be able to host Senator McCaskill today. She's actually been moving around the northwest part of Missouri over the past couple of days, talking with the different planning agencies in our corner of the state to hear what issues our members, our local governments, our citizens in this region are really concerned about from the federal level. And so we are just thrilled that she was able to make some time in her schedule to come up and talk to us today. I'm not going to go into her whole bio. She's been a public servant for a long, long time, and she's a real proponent, not just of Missouri, but also of Northwest Missouri. And so we are very thankful that she is here, and I would ask that you welcome her to the microphone.
Welcome to all of you, and I believe that we are also streaming this live online, is that correct? Yes. So it's good to be here in a technology and innovation center because they have the appropriate capability for us to stream live online. So not only do we have a chance today to talk and visit about a bunch of issues, but anybody who's interested can watch it online and hopefully see a little accountability in action, me trying to be out here listening and learning from you. And hearing your concerns and complaints and questions and hopefully being able to address those in a way that while I can't make everybody happy, at least you know I'm trying to get out here and be accountable to you. So the way we have learned over the years doing this, I do a lot of town halls. I have frankly, throughout the time I've been in office. And we average about 25 town halls a year. And this is our third one in 2 days on this particular break from home. I've got a lot more scheduled over the coming weeks all around Missouri, and I try to do at least several of these every time I come home from Washington for longer than a weekend because I think it kind of grounds me. You know, there's two really big dangers in Washington. The first one is that the priority with way too many people out there is one simple concept, and that is, how do I get to stay? And everything is done around the politics of being able to win re-election. And it's really hard to solve hard problems if you are afraid to do anything that's controversial. If you're just focused on making everybody happy, that's a really good prescription for just kicking things down the road. Because it's hard to solve hard problems in this country without making somebody mad. It's just almost impossible. So that's one of the problems. The other problem is you get out there and you can get to thinking you're a big deal. Everybody's pretty deferential out there. You're kind of in a bubble. It's Senator this, Senator that. And, you know, coming home and doing meetings like this helps ground me and remind me that this is not about me. It's about you. It's about the folks here in Missouri and common sense and trying to find consensus and compromise and not being afraid to be independent and do things that you think are right, even if maybe your party doesn't agree with you or your next-door neighbor doesn't agree with you. And even sometimes it's hard because you think that doing the right thing may mean that many people in Missouri don't agree with you for a variety of different reasons. So that's why I'm here, and we've learned through these town hall processes that to try to be fair, we ask people to fill out questions ahead of time. We put them in a basket, and then I generally try to find somebody who doesn't look too friendly to draw the questions out, because I figure we want to make sure that it's not a stacked deck. You don't look like you're happy, so would you mind drawing the questions out?
You got that right.
Okay. Would you mind holding the basket and drawing them out for the whole thing and just handing them to me?
All right.
Okay. He really isn't happy. I'm not sure he's even happy about drawing the questions out, but I appreciate you doing this because that way nobody thinks I'm trying to only answer easy questions. So thank you, sir, very much, and I appreciate it. Thank you. The first question is from Steve Miller. Steve Miller, yes, would you like me to read this question, or do you want to just ask whatever you'd like?
I can ask.
Okay.
What what's the future, in your opinion, of AFCA?
AFCA is a initiative that was concerning the ability of employees to organize and into unions in this country. There are various parts of AFCA. I don't think that there's the support out there, and frankly, if there was going to be the support out there, it would have been voted on for ballot check, for card check. I don't think that the support is there. And my view on it is that we probably ought to start with the secret ballot concept for everything. People want to have secret ballots for deciding to unionize. I would like us to see have a secret ballot for trying to do away with the union. Right now, we have card check for doing away with unions, and to me, that also should be a secret ballot, because the point here is to keep pressure off the person who's deciding, by management or by the people who want a union, and allow each individual to make that decision. So what I've been talking about is that we need to have a secret ballot at the other end of the process, not just a secret ballot at the front end of the process, but a secret ballot at the other end of the process. There is a constant negotiation going on with Business Roundtable, with representatives of unions. They are continuing to work and trying to find a compromise that is amenable to business and that moves the concept of people being able to have the opportunity to have a collective voice in the workplace. And those negotiations are continuing, and I don't think that there's going to be anything that's going to be in front of the Senate, certainly this year, on that subject. We can't even pass motherhood and apple pie at this point because it's the silly season. You know, we're in campaign mode, and so everybody's worried that if we pass anything that's too good, then it hurts them, and, you know, it's some folks want the place to appear to be completely dysfunctional because that kind of goes with the mantra, throw everybody out. And so we're really into kind of political strategizing in terms of what we're doing in Washington, which is unfortunate because there's real work that needs to be done, and it's unfortunate that the place shuts down for 3 or 4 months before elections while everybody postures. I won't get started now. Maybe an earmark question will come up and I can expound on that a little bit more, because the earmarking is a great idea of where people are posturing and they're not sincere about it. Eileen Morrison from Fairfax. Yes, Eileen, would you like me to read your question, or would you like just to state whatever question you'd like to ask?
Well, actually, it's about the question on there. I'm a small business owner, and to be real honest, this health care reform is scaring me to death. I'm right at that 50 employee mark. Mm-hmm. Every year, I have reinvested in my company. And I've grown the company. I've reinvested almost all the profit I've made back into the company. I started out with 3 employees, and now I'm up to 50. In the summer, I'm up to 75. But now I have to make a decision. Do I stop growing my company because I'm not going to be able to afford the health care? We do provide health care for our employees. I pay 50%. Maybe out of the 50, we have 20 people that have opted in. Even though I pay 50%. And what also concerns me is part-time employees. We have a lot of part-time, we have a lot of turnover. Once they leave our employment, if we do get over that 50 mark and we have to provide health insurance for all of these people, then you've got the COBRA to worry about. Now we've got all of these people that now we have to pay COBRA for. And my understanding is that you would get a tax break the next year. Well, if you can't afford to pay it this year, a tax break next year is not going to do you any good.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions. What is the total amount that you pay right now on out of your company's bottom line for health care coverage for employees?
Right now, with 20 employees, and it's about $200 a month for the ones that, per employee. Mm-hmm. Now, the ones that have
families. Well, somebody do the math for me there real quickly. $200 a month times 12, so you're paying over 2,000. You're paying over
20.
No, but I'm saying if you're paying $200 a month per year for each employee, you're paying over $2,000.
Right.
Well, if you decided not to give health insurance to anybody, you'd save money because the most you'd ever have to pay is $2,000 per employee. You're paying more right now for that than you would even if you go much over the 50 employees. And if you're paying 50% of the premium right now, and that's available to your employees, then in all likelihood, and I have to look at, we'd have to look at the specifics of your company, they wouldn't even be eligible to opt out and go to the exchange, which is the only thing that would trigger you being penalized. So I don't think there's, I understand the concerns, because this is hard when you aren't really sure how this is going to work. And you've got health care. You go, well, this worries me, because maybe somehow mine's going to get taken away. Well, all of a sudden, mine's going to get a lot more expensive, or it's going to be a lot more expensive for my company. One of the reasons you're paying 50%, and you know most of your employees aren't taking it, is because it's so expensive.
It is.
If it wasn't so expensive, you'd provide more coverage, and you'd cover more employees. And by the way, the count on employees doesn't include part-time people. They do not count.
If you have five part-time people that average over 30 hours a week, doesn't that count?
But the part-time people aren't part of the computation as to how much you would pay if you didn't provide insurance, is what I'm saying.
And who's going to cover the spouse and the children of these employees?
There's no requirement to cover the spouse and the children.
But I mean, if everybody's supposed to have health care, where are they going to get their health care?
What they're going to do, which is the best part, I think, about the bill, is they're going to come to a state-based, not federally-based, local exchange. I mean, has anybody ever shopped on Expedia or Priceline? You know how you go there and you have lots of different choices you can make, but they're all private companies. That will be the same thing for health insurance. There will be a number of different kinds of policies, from very, very bare bones, you know, what they call catastrophic care, to very bells and whistles, everything's covered. People will have choices of what they buy. Depending on what their income is, there will be assistance with those premiums if those premiums are too high. And this is all going to be done at the state level. And the good news is the state can go with other states and join together so the insurance can be sold across state lines so you have an even larger pool. Let me ask you right now, the people that right now that work for you that don't have insurance, if something terrible happens to them, where do they go?
I actually know, because one of our employees, his wife, had emergency surgery. And he wanted to borrow $500 from me because he didn't have the amount to start it. And so then he has to pay $500 a month to the hospital for her $10,000 surgery. So that's what happened to them.
Well, and he's being very responsible.
Yes.
You understand that there's a whole lot of people that show up at the hospital and we just take care of them. Now, who do you think pays for that? Is there a tooth fairy somewhere that pays for that? No. That's why the insurance has gotten so expensive. All of the uninsured care, which is climbing and climbing. You ask the people here at Heartland, the uninsured care, one of the reasons the hospitals were for this is because they understand what's really going on in our healthcare system right now. As more and more companies can't afford to provide coverage, more and more people are going bare. They may be deciding to buy a new truck instead of paying for health care. They may decide that they want a new house instead of paying for health care, because they know that in America, if something horrible happens, we're going to take care of them. So they just roll the dice. And then we take care of them. But we take care of them in the most expensive way imaginable, through the emergency room. What this bill does is it says everyone is going to have to take some responsibility. It's going to be affordable. There's going to be choices. It's not going to be government run. And in most instances, I think if you drill down, I get the reaction that big government, bad government, don't trust them. But if you drill down, I will be shocked at this bill not being more helpful to your small business in the current situation you're faced with now, where you never know year to year how bad is the premium increase going to be, what can I really afford to give my employees, and how many more am I going to have to say, I'm sorry, I can't afford to keep my business open and provide health care. We're trying to break that cycle. Is it perfect? No. Did we make some mistakes? Your other question about the 1099s, that has to be fixed. And we will fix that. We'll fix it before the end of the year. That was an attempt to collect taxes that are due that people now aren't paying. Because if you get a whole bunch of reimbursement from your company for things, you're supposed to be paying taxes on that. Those are benefits to you. A lot of Americans aren't paying those taxes. Some are and some aren't. So that was an attempt to do that, but it was a clumsy attempt because it's going to put too much of a burden on businesses in terms of paperwork. So we've got to get at that those folks that aren't paying their taxes in a way that doesn't penalize the businesses. We need to like figure out how it's put the burdens put on the taxpayer, not on the businesses. And in fact, there was already an amendment that has been drafted to deal with that, and it has wide support in the Senate. So that's a good example of something we've already realized, okay, we need to tweak that. That's not going to have the impact that we want it to have, and that will continue to happen. That's why it doesn't all happen at once. That's why it's getting rolled in over time, so we can assess, as things happen, is this working? Is this working for America? We know the old system was not working very well. And it was only a matter of time that we had 14 people left in America with health insurance that were paying $5 million a year for the coverage, and everyone else was going to emergency rooms trying to figure out how they could get health care without having to pay those really, really high premiums. And I won't take time now to go into other provisions. Maybe there'll be other questions about it, and I'm happy to do that if there are. But I don't want to take too much time on this because I want to get to more questions. Thank you very much for being here. And if you have specific questions, anybody, if you have specific questions about your business and healthcare, please contact Greg. He is from my office, and he is in charge of outreach in this part of the state, and we will get you directly with people who can answer specific questions about your business as it relates to new healthcare law. And all of you who have employees 25 or less, be sure you take advantage, and you're paying, how many of you have businesses that have 25 employees or less? Anybody? Okay. Are you paying healthcare, any of you? Okay, be sure and check, because you'll get 35% of what you're paying this year back from the government. And next year you'll get 50% of what you're paying back from the government as a tax credit. Trying to continue to encourage small businesses to provide health care, even though it's gotten very, very expensive. This is from John McKinnon.
Right here.
Yes, John.
Hi, I'm a Northwest Missouri farmer, and we started out with John Deere and Tom Farnahan on the windmill projects. First thing, I want to thank you for what you've done at Arlington, the problems that there is at Arlington Cemetery. I believe you handled that so far pretty well.
Thank you.
Okay. I just, what's your thoughts on cap and trade? I know that's a pretty big deal, but what's your thought on cap and trade?
This is one of the places where the president and I disagree. I have said, much to the chagrin, and usually some of them are here. Is there any of the folks here? Some of the folks that really believe in cap and trade follow me around sometimes to these town halls and get on me about it. The Sierra Club and some of the folks that really want cap and trade are very upset with me. There's about 12 of us that are Democrats in the Senate that have kind of put our foot down and said we're not for putting a price on carbon, not in the way they were doing it. The reason I don't support it is it will penalize Missouri unfairly. Missouri is coal dependent. It's not like we have a choice. You guys have some choices in Northwest Missouri because you have wind. I know that we have Rockport, maybe only city in America that's completely powered by wind. And as we drove through those windmills last night, I'm so used to summer evenings in Missouri and rural Missouri being so beautiful with the rolling hills and all the hay. And then we drive through those windmills. I felt like I was in a Star Wars movie. They are cool looking. They are very cool looking. But most Missourians don't have any choice.
Right.
Their electricity comes from coal. And until we have the technology, until we figure out a way to do it that what we generate is going back to help people like in states in Missouri, that would pay more than almost any other state for their power because of our coal dependence. I think it's a mistake, particularly in this economy, to put a price on carbon. And frankly, creating a new derivative market for carbon trading right now, after what I saw with derivatives and that hearing with Goldman Sachs and the games that were being played with derivatives, I think we need to figure out if we've got a control of derivative trading before we start creating new derivatives in a carbon market. The other part of it that I'm uncomfortable about is it's the same atmosphere all over the world. Unlike maybe some of you, I believe global warming is real, and I think it's a problem we need to deal with. But it is the same atmosphere. And we are fighting for manufacturing jobs right now. We need to make things in America. I believe in making things in America. And if we don't have India and China on board, they're putting up coal-fired plants every 10 minutes. And it's going to chase our manufacturing over to India and China. And we're fighting to hold on to manufacturing now. So I am not there. That doesn't mean we shouldn't continue the incentives we have for alternative energy. And that's why I'm working very hard to make sure that we extend all of those incentives that are out there that have made your wind farm possible, that have made the ethanol and biodiesel plants around Missouri possible. We've got to get those tax credits extended so that all of those businesses have certainty as it relates to their planning in terms of their business.
Thanks.
Okay, next question. Robert Sawyer.
Here.
Yes, sir.
There's two on there. One, I like your observations. You probably can't read my writing. Not you can't read, I just can't write. I'm concerned, those two I'm most concerned about, the fact that as an industrialized nation now, we rank 12 out of 26 on the percent of kids finishing college. What's your take on that?
And race to the top?
Perhaps we're admitting students that aren't qualified.
I appreciate that this administration, we may have some teachers in the room. Do we have any teachers? I appreciate that teachers... I know who my good teachers were. I bet all of you know who your good teachers were. I bet you also know who your bad teachers were. But we have not yet in education figured out how we assess that and how we reward good performance and frankly cull out the teachers that really are not as good as they need to be in the classroom. And this administration is trying to tackle that in spite of the fact that the National Education Association in Missouri and MSTA and all of those groups and all of the AFT and all of those are not really thrilled about it. They're at the table because they realize that this is something we need to get our arms around. That's what Race to the Top is all about. We're trying to get off of this notion that No Child Behind was all about punishing for an arbitrary standard, forcing people to teach to the test, really having very good school districts feel like they're not doing a good job because they haven't met some arbitrary number. We need to get away from that and start really encouraging excellence by incentives and measuring progress, not an arbitrary number. So No Child Left Behind will not be renewed the way it is. It will be changed, and I believe there's enough support for it to have those kinds of concepts instead of the No Child Left Behind concepts.
I'm concerned that out of the 21 states that are going to be eligible for the Race to the Top, Missouri is not one of them.
They're not because we didn't win that competition. There will be more assessments, and part of that is, does a state, have they embraced looking at teacher performance? That's one of the criteria that this administration is using, even though some of the base support of the Democratic Party is not excited about it. This president and the Secretary of Education thinks that they do not, part of the Race to the Top is, have you tackled the issue of teacher performance? So that's why I think we didn't compete this first round well, but doesn't mean we won't in the future. And I know that a lot of educators around the state are continuing to work to see how we can prevail in that. In terms of graduation rates, you're exactly right. And one of the problems we've had, and I was glad to hear the president here talk about the successful graduation rates, we've had a tendency to focus on how many people get enrolled in college and how many Pell Grant eligible kids do we have and how many kids have gotten financial aid. And we've lost track of their success, particularly after the first year, where you see the big drop-off of people dropping out. And by the way, I've got one child that is in this category. He got 2 years done, and I'm now making him understand that he's going to have a job and not a career, because he's having to pay his own way now in his apartment. He actually was complaining that he left his light on the other day, and I thought, you know, lightning is going to strike me dead. My son just is worried about whether or not he left a light on. But he quit after 2 years, and he's got to figure out that he's got to get back and finish that degree. There are a lot of kids out there that give up or quit after 2 years because they haven't found the thing that really interests them or they haven't done well. And a lot of this is the way we've incentivized colleges with funding. You know, the Pell Grants, we've increased the Pell Grants, which are great for schools like this. But these not-for-profit schools that are online, they have exploded. And they are using inappropriate recruitment. Have you seen the commercials? You know, sign up for this online school and you'll get your master's and you'll do all this. Well, a lot of that is really people who just want to get kids in that have the Pell Grant. They collect that federal money or those federally guaranteed student loans, and then they don't care if those kids ever graduate. And they're not even recruiting kids that are appropriate for the challenge they're going to face because they just want that money from the federal government. So we're in the process of taking a very hard look at the not-for-profit online schools and figuring out, I want to see them not get their Pell money until the kids graduated. And then they get the Pell money. But if they can't produce a graduate, I don't think the federal government should be paying them. And for the not-for-profit online schools, I mean, obviously we've got some capital needs that you have in an institution like this. But these online schools don't have buildings. And lots of times they don't have teachers. They just have online curriculum that they pump out. So they have very little capital costs, and so they're very profitable, right? That's why they've exploded. It's like the next subprime, in my opinion, scandal that we're trying to get a handle on right now. This doesn't have a name. So I'm going to skip it. If we have time, I'll come back and do the question. But I want to get to everyone that put their name on it before we do ones that
I'm
are
not numbers. Looking at these now.
Rachel Ost.
Ost,
yes, Rachel.
Unemployment is a major burden, especially in this part of the state. What are you actively doing to change that?
This is one of the hardest parts about this recession. When the crisis occurred, and we had no overnight lending in our financial institutions, and everything was about to fall off the table, we did some big, bold things to keep it from completely going into a depression. We did a massive amount of loaning to major, major financial institutions. I'm glad to tell you that a huge portion of that, I think 70 to 80% of that has been paid back with interest. We actually made money on it. We still have money outstanding at GM, but they're getting there, and I think they will end up getting us back all of that debt. We still have some of their stock. I think within another 2 years, they've now turned the corner on profitability. We've saved a good American company, and I think we're going to get all that money back. Chrysler is still a little iffy. I bought a Jeep yesterday trying to help. Used. I bought a used Jeep yesterday trying to help. I don't know that Chrysler will make it, but it's in a much better shape today than it was 18 months ago. And we did the stimulus. Now, the stimulus has been very unpopular. Okay. It's ironic to me the stimulus has been so unpopular. For all of you teachers that are here and all of you people that have been worried about the cuts in state government, $800 million was cut out of the state budget this year. Do you know what that figure would have been if we hadn't done the stimulus? $3.5 billion. Every road project you see, $22 million to Atchison County for their water system. Every road project you see, the work we're doing on the rail lines, which is very important for farmers in terms of freight and our capability of moving freight, all of that was stimulus. And a third of it all just went directly to the states. They didn't balance the budget down in Jeff City the last 2 years on Missouri money. They balanced that budget with federal stimulus money. Now, I thought it was interesting. They were busy railing on about how much they hated the stimulus, and they were going, give me more, give me more, give me more, you know, which I think is, frankly, a little unfair. A third of the money was a tax cut, which all of you are still getting. Any of you who get a paycheck, you've been paying less taxes on your payroll taxes for the last year and will continue through the end of this year. And the remaining money is the money that I talked about with the various road projects and the that we're getting high-speed broadband in many parts of rural Missouri from it. But at a certain point in time, when we've stabilized the economy, we can't keep spending federal money. This has to be about small businesses and the private sector. We are not going to get back to healthy job growth in this country with government payroll. We're only going to get there with small business and free enterprise. So we've got to do things that now help small businesses that have made it through the rough patch and they're ready to grow. We need to get help to them. So we have pending right now a small business bill that will give more tax cuts to small businesses, almost $12 billion. And any of you are interested in the specifics of that bill, I'm happy to get it to you. But it will, and also provide a $30 billion loan fund that small banks, not big banks, only community banks, can, if they want, draw down for loans to small businesses. They're not required to take it. It's just there if they want some additional capital to be available to loan to small businesses, they can. Now, we're having trouble getting that part passed because it's the silly season, as I mentioned before, and somebody started calling it TARP 2. I don't know, somebody on Fox or someplace started calling it TARP 2. It's not, it doesn't have anything to do with rescuing banks. It has to do with providing capital to small businesses for loans. It has nothing to do with shoring up banks. But because it was called that, we got a bunch of folks on the other side now, they went, oh, we can't do TARP 2. And I'm going, it's not TARP 2. But that's some of the things we're trying to do to get help to small businesses. But the government cannot and should not ever take the entire burden of trying to lift a country out of a recession. That's how we end up being Greece. And we can't be Greece. We've got to keep our fiscal house in order to remain the kind of powerful nation that we've always been. Barbara Petalon from Maryville.
Yes. You can read that because you're talking about
small businesses.
Small business.
How do you expect small businesses to find good employees who are told, I can make more money getting government programs than I can working? Now these programs have been extended with my tax dollars. Well, now this is interesting. We got two questions back to back. I bet you're looking for a job.
Uh-huh. I have my resume, too, so.
And you're looking every day.
Yeah.
And you've looked for a long time.
Over a year, yeah.
Okay. I'm not saying there aren't people out there like that, Ms. Petalon.
What I am trying to point out is, as you are trying to help the people who are unemployed, and there's a segment of people that certainly need help, we are getting more and more of this from people that's like, no, I can't work. I'm making more money with the government programs than I ever could working, and we pay above minimum wage. And to me, it's going to be small business that gets us out of this. That's all there is to it. You know that. I know that. But somehow, in the government trying to help, you're actually hurting small businesses that could get us out of that. I'm just trying to find out what the answer is.
Well, I understand there are some people out there like that. But there's a whole lot of people like this young lady.
Right.
You can't argue that we are still at historically difficult high levels of unemployment. And I've not met, I mean, first of all, the unemployment benefits are not better than minimum wage. They aren't.
Well, and by the time they go through the process, and I even ask a couple of people what they qualify for, and these people know the programs well, trust me. Mm-hmm. And until that runs out, they aren't even going to talk to us about jobs. And I'm not saying most people are like this. They aren't. I'm just telling you, in the past year, we have seen more people and a rise in these people. So this is going to be another problem that's going to have to be addressed in trying to fix a problem.
Well, the reason that there was so much difficulty extending unemployment this last time is people are beginning to ask these questions. I said to the leader of my party, somebody's got to tell me when we stop. You know, this can't become another entitlement program. This has to wind down. We cannot continue this level of unemployment. It's way too expensive. It's way too expensive for our government. So I certainly understand your point. And so we're weighing the two issues. People who are trying hard every day to get work, and we're trying to keep foreclosures from all happening, people losing their homes, and children who have parents who, you know, have no way to support them, and then they end up falling into the welfare system or to on the backs of charities and social service agencies. So we're trying to do that balance, and I completely understand the point you're making, and I think that is going to happen. I think we will begin winding these programs down. I will be surprised if we extend again. I think that the support is getting less and less for extending again. Your second point, you disagree with the fact that only 3% of small businesses would be affected by tax cuts for people making over, it's $250,000 a year to expire.
What I am saying to that is many small businesses like us who have expanded that started out with just a handful and are growing, and believe it or not, we've actually grown in the past 2 years during this.
Yeah.
Now, I grab my heart and I ask my husband, are you crazy? You know, because I was scared, but we went ahead and did it anyway. I don't know how it's going to end up. So far, it's doing okay. The only reason we're allowed to do that is because when we reorganized our business, we have to report the business profits as our personal income, which we in turn put back into the business so we can hire these people, so we can grow Without those task cuts, we can't do that. So lately, because we don't know what's going to happen, we're at a standstill because we're scared to death.
Well, and I'm happy to get you all happy to get you the specifics. In fact, if there was a really good debate between probably the most respected Republican economist, Doug Holtz Erskine, and Tim Geithner about the top two tax brackets and how many taxpayers it will affect. I'm not saying that there isn't not a lot of income that it may impact, but the Republicans are taking overall small business income and trying to impute that that's the number of taxpayers. Well, hedge funds are counted as small business income. Passive investments that people get are considered small business income, but the number of taxpayers, including those that have S-corp income, is only 3% of America.
Okay, we'll see.
And by the way, the tax rate that we're talking about going back to for that 3% is the same tax rate that was there during the 90s when everybody made a lot of money. I mean, that's what's ironic about this. People are so anxious to go hold on to the economic policies that were in place between 2000 and 2008. And if you look at the two decades, what kind of income growth there was in America, what kind of job growth there was in America, whether or not we balanced the budget. The economic policies of the 90s was so much better than what happened in the years between 2000 and 2008. Less jobs were created. We get into a deficit. So why would we now think it's a really good idea to hold on to the same policies that created this mess this young lady is suffering right now? That's what I don't get. I mean, we're not talking about going back to the tax rates they were under Reagan when there was a lot higher. We're talking about 3% downgrade in terms of a 3% increase in taxes for 3% of America. And by the way, we can't get to the deficit if we don't look at every part of the equation. Anybody who thinks we're going to do away with deficits with tax cuts has not been paying attention to what's happened in our country the last 40 years. It doesn't do it. So I'm for holding on to all the tax cuts. I'm for this bill that will do $12 billion more. And I bet if you look at the list, you're going to be very happy at the tax cuts we're talking about doing for small business that are targeted to businesses just like yours and your husband's. But frankly, I'm not worried about Paris Hilton. You know, I'm not worried about her. I'm worried about you and your husband. And I think we can do that if we'll get past the politics and try to really start talking about the substance of these economic policies. I think we can enact the policies that will allow the middle class to thrive. And that's what this is about.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Once again, this is really a political question, too. Some good Democrat in the audience wrote this, so I'm not going to do this one because I'm here as the senator and not as running for office. So whoever wrote the one about the Carnahan-Blunt race, God love you, but I'm not going to go there today. Jane Walter from Conception.
Yes.
Would you like to just ask your question?
Sure.
If you would like?
Yes.
Okay.
The U.S. border with Mexico needs to be secured, and those here illegally need to be arrested and deported. Why is Arizona being criticized for trying to protect itself when the U.S. government refuses to? And why are sanctuary cities ignored when they are blatantly ignoring the federal law? Are you for or against amnesty for illegals? And is anything going to be done about those who enter the U.S. specifically just to have their children born here in the U.S.?
Okay.
So I'd like you to speak about illegals.
Sure. I'm happy to talk about immigration. I do not favor amnesty, and I voted that way. I campaigned saying that I would not vote that way, and that's exactly the way I voted. I have voted every chance I've had for Republican amendments to increase border security. One of the few Democrats that have done that. I'm very proud that last week, I was shocked, but I think John McCain and John Kyle convinced their Republican colleagues, a bill that I co-sponsored on increased border security actually passed the Senate last week. And yesterday, it passed the House, but on a different bill. I may actually have to cancel some of my meetings for Friday and fly back to Washington so we can bring that bill back up on the floor of the Senate, even though we're supposed to be in adjournment, call the Senate back into session long enough to do the technical things we must do to embrace what the House has done, which is identical to our bill. They just put it in a different vehicle. They put it in a different piece of legislation, so the number is different. So we would have to go back and once again pass it so we could go to the president for signature. And let me tell you what's great about this bill. I'm a former prosecutor. I know about deterring crime, and I know about bringing resources to a problem. And you don't, like when we had the big, huge meth problem in Jackson County, you don't go knock on every house looking for a meth lab. You focus your resources based on the intelligence where you know the problem is. You put together strike forces. This is going to be 1,500 border agents organized in strike forces with the technical support they need with aerial drones for real-time surveillance photography. Much more effective than a fence. We are taking out more than half of the Al-Qaeda leadership with armed aerial unmanned drones in the northern region of Pakistan. We can use that same technology on the border, and that's what this bill will pay for. It also pays for more space for detention, more money for deportation. Now, do I think that our country can afford to deport 11 million people? I don't think you want us to spend what it would take to deport 11 million people. But do we need to increase deportation, especially for people who have committed crimes? We do, and guess what? We have. Deportation is up, and the percentage of the people that are being deported that have committed crimes is 60% higher than it was before 2008. We have to go after employers that are hiring illegal immigrants as employees knowingly. That is essential in this fight because they're not coming across the border. I mean, I disagree with you that they're coming to have babies. They're coming to get a job. They're not coming to have babies. They're coming to get a job. They're coming to make money. And the reason they've been coming to make money is because people have been hiring them knowing that nothing was going to happen to them when they hired them. In the previous administration, they'd do workplace raids with photo ops, and nothing would happen to the employers. The previous head of immigration told me in a committee hearing that she couldn't even tell me how many employers. They didn't even keep track of how many employers they prosecuted. Well, no wonder the border was like a sieve. People were coming because it was not a problem getting work. And it was not fear of the businesses that were playing by the rules and paying all of the things you've got to pay for an employee if you're legitimately hired. They're paying them cash under the table. Half the wages they're paying other people. The audits of businesses are dramatically up. And they are quietly, methodically targeting the businesses that have been the ones most likely to use a large number of illegal immigrants. I understand what the people of Arizona did. I understand their frustration. There are parts of their bill I think are great. There are parts of their bill that I don't think the Constitution is going to support. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't have done what they did. They got the nation's attention to their problem. And I think one of the reasons that we were able to get this bill passed is because of the People of Arizona Act. So I don't have any criticism for the people of Arizona. The best part about this bill, which I like the most, is the way we figured out how to pay for it. There are foreign companies that have come to America, which is not bad. We want foreign companies to come and invest in America, right? We want that. But they brought their employees with them. And so there are companies that are more than half of their workforce is on H-1B visas. And we're not talking about now agricultural jobs. We're not talking about picking produce. We're not talking about chicken processing. We're talking about sitting behind a desk at a computer, H-1B visas, okay? So the companies that have more than 50% of their workforce on H-1B visas, now we're going to have to pay thousands of dollars to get more of them. And the best news was the day after we passed the bill in the Wall Street Journal, one of these companies, one of these Indian companies, was quoted as saying, well, this means we'll have to hire more Americans. Don't you love it? I love that. I love that. It is like the whipped cream and the cherry on this sundae that we're going to get more border security. It's going to be effective and smart and tough. And at the same time, it's going to be paid for by people who think it's a good idea to put skilled workers behind a computer from another country rather than hiring Americans like this young lady that's working very hard to try to find a job. We're going to get you a job before this is over.
I hope so.
I'm going to keep touting you up here. She's got a resume. She's got a resume.
Yeah.
Melvin Crane.
Right here.
Yes, sir.
How can you curtail the, I think I wrote influence, but the buyouts by special interests, Let's face it, the perception of the American public, and by much of the press, is that you people are for sale.
I know. I know. I wish I had a really good answer for you. I harp on earmarks, but earmarks are a good example. There are a few earmarks that get there because communities come to directly to their congressman or their senator. But the vast majority of the earmarks that are done because there are special lobbying shops that do nothing but hire clients that want earmarks. Most of the people who get earmarks get them because they can afford to hire a lobbyist, which is another reason that they're bad. I think the best way to do it is by disclosure. And that's why this Citizens United case, I think, is very dangerous. You know, the people of Missouri voted in an overwhelming fashion to put campaign finance limits on contributions in Missouri. Do you all remember that in 2007? Wasn't even close. The legislature the next year said, forget it. We're going to say no limits. So it's the Wild Wild West in Missouri. You've got candidates for state rep and state senator that are getting $20,000, $30,000 checks to run for office. Now, who gives a state representative $20,000 or $30,000? Who does that? Why would you give a state representative $20,000 or $30,000 to run for office? Now, it's your right to, I guess, under the law in Missouri right now. But one thing Missouri at least does is you know where it came from. Because you've got to report real-time those contributions within like 24 or 48 hours. I'm not sure what the law is, but it's within a very short period of time you've got to report that. What the Citizens United case said is not only can corporations spend as much as they want against or for a candidate, they don't have to tell you who they are and how much they're spending. Now, that's an activist court. You know, I love it when people say, well, I don't want an activist court. Well, people don't want an activist court unless they're deciding the way they like it. And then all of a sudden, an activist court is great. All my friends across the aisle that hate an activist court and every nominee that comes down, well, we don't want an activist judge. This court blew away every precedent that we had in our law and said all of a sudden that corporations are people and their First Amendment rights have to be protected and we don't have the right to. And now we can't even get the other side to let us pass a disclosure law. I mean, let the people know who's paying for these things. Have you guys seen the ads? There's an ad running for me in Missouri. I have no idea who did that ad. I'd like to know. I have no idea where their money came from. And it was for me. And it made me nervous. It makes me nervous when people say, I'm great. I don't know who they are and where the money came from. There's a whole bunch of ads you're going to see in the next few months because we have a contested Senate race. Don't pay attention to any ad that doesn't tell you who paid for it. Just forget about it. Just when it says citizens that love America, don't pay any attention to it. Or paid for by citizens that think that apple pie is a great dessert. Don't pay any attention to it. Or citizens that don't want you to have to pay taxes. Make them tell you who's paying for the ads. That would do a lot. That would do a lot. The second thing is little money. And one of the things, and I know that the president in many ways has lost a lot of confidence in people, particularly in rural Missouri, over the last 18 months. But one of the things about his campaign that was remarkable to me was the amount of little money that he attracted. Now, he got big contributions. I'm not saying he didn't. But it was unprecedented in the history of our country that he raised almost $600 million and the average contribution was about 55 bucks. The internet allows people to put little bitty amounts of money in campaigns. How many of you have ever given a campaign contribution to anybody? Raise your hand. Okay. How many of you have given a campaign contribution over $20,000? Okay. This is the kind of room we're looking for. We're looking for a room full of people that pays attention, whether it's a school board candidate or a candidate for mayor or a candidate for president, and you say, you know, I'm going to give 10 bucks. I'm going to go on the internet. I'm going to give 10 bucks. If a whole bunch of folks will start giving a little amount of money, that will be the best antiseptic of all. Because then you don't have to rely on these big contributions to pay for these TV ads. You know how much money I had to raise to win an election in the United States Senate? $12 million. These two candidates running for the Senate in Missouri, you know what they're going to raise together this year? They're going to probably raise close to $50 million that we raised and spent on the Senate race. Now, just think how great if that was all $10 contributions, how that would change the way things happen. So little money. So I always tell women, find that blouse in your closet that you thought was the right color and looked great because it was on sale. Whatever you paid for that blouse, find a candidate you believe in and give that as a campaign contribution. That'll help. Okay, I think we're done. There was a couple of anonymous ones I'll do.
We have time for one more.
One was, what does it mean that the Federal Reserve is buying a percentage of the debt? Well, it means that we are trying to manage the debt in a way that does not upset the economy, just like they try to manage interest rates. Interest rates are very low. The cost of money is very low because they're trying to spur economic activity. I will tell you that they have managed, with the discount window and the other things they've done, we got through a really rocky time. And let me close with this, because it was a moment that a lot of Americans think was a bad thing that happened. And let me tell you from my perspective what was remarkable about what happened in September of 2008. It was the silly season. We were about to have a presidential election. And nobody in America had felt this crisis. Nobody even knew there was the crisis that was as serious as it was. If we have any bankers in the room that understand how overnight lending is essential in our country, as it relates to LIBOR and the interest rates that are paid all over and the fact that money moves on a constant basis. I will never forget the day that the Secretary of the Treasury and the President of the Federal Reserve walked in a very small room with a bipartisan group of senators, and the looks on their faces told me that we were in trouble. They were clearly panicked. They were very, very worried. At that moment, you had two men running for president that knew that America didn't know there was a crisis and knew what this was going to look like. That it was going to look like that we were so busy worried about the big dudes on Wall Street, nobody cared about what was going on in Main Street. Either John McCain or Barack Obama said, I'm against this. I'm not going to participate in a bailout of Wall Street because that's not what the American people want. And you know what? It probably would have helped him get elected president because nobody felt it on Main Street yet. But both of those men, and almost everyone, in fact, you know, Senator Bond and Congressman Blunt and me, and I mean everybody from the most liberal member to the most conservative member, in an unbelievable bipartisan fashion, we came together on the eve of election and did something that was going to be controversial because we were very worried about our country. John McCain's campaign slogan, Country First, he lived it because he was behind. And even though I can be critical of him on a lot of things we disagree on, I admire what he did at that moment because he did what he thought was best for the country. And I think the history books will look back on what we did during that time of crisis and say that America's democracy is still pretty darn healthy because we were able to put aside the electioneering long enough to do something dramatic that ultimately stabilized our financial system. And even though we're not well yet, we are a heck of a lot better position today than we were on that very scary day in September of 2008 when we had to do something dramatic to shore up the very top part of our financial system. And I think we've now taken steps to keep that from ever happening again. I am blessed to have this job. And you all have been incredibly polite and kind today, and I know there's a lot of people, and I'm worried you didn't get a question. You sure you don't want to ask me something?
Yeah, I do.
All right. You've got to draw all the questions, and I know you're upset, so why don't you get the last question?
All right. The what you've been talking about, the bailing out of the big banks and stuff, and everything that's been done for against and for Wall Street, you forgot two entities, that's the two 500-pound gorillas out there, and that's Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Nothing was done about them. There was alarm bells went off several years ago, but Chris Dodd and Barney Franks killed it. And in my estimation, they're the one that started this whole mess.
Well, I know that's what some folks say, and by the way, I know that we've got offenders on both sides here. We've got the people on the left turn into Rachel and Ed and Keith Oberman, and they say, oh, we're right. And the people on the right turn into Sean and Hannity and all those guys and say, oh, we're right. And frankly, the truth's somewhere in the middle. Both sides are basically trying to attract an audience that agrees with them instead of really worrying about whether or not they're given the straight scoop. It's not like the old days with Huntley and Brinkley, right? Or Walter Cronkite. But let me just, The bottom line is that Fannie and Freddie have been dealt with because the problem that occurred is we decided there was a housing policy in this country, on a bipartisan basis we decided, that there should be a housing policy in this country that should encourage home ownership. And rather than put regulations in place, and both sides had an opportunity to do this and they didn't, they actually let people go out and make money closing loans and they didn't have to care whether or not the people could pay the money back. In other words, they let people make money on loans that had no skin in the game. So if you can make money off selling a loan to somebody that you know that can't pay it back, but you don't have any consequences, guess what you're going to do? You're going to go out and try to convince people who can't afford houses that they can't afford a house because you're going to make money on it. It's not your problem because that's all going to be sliced and diced and sold to other people. It doesn't make any difference to you whether they pay the money back. We've changed that. That was the seminal problem that caused this. No skin in the game by people who were closing these loans. Should people have bought these houses they couldn't afford? Of course not. But they were told, you know, this house is going to increase in value. By the time you've got to turn this loan over for a higher interest rate, you're going to have more equity because this house is going to increase in value. You're not going to have to worry. Well, you're in this house. You want this house. This person's telling you it's going to be fine. You haven't gotten full disclosure of what's going on. And it wasn't just Fannie and Freddie. It was every mortgage company that was moving these loans, Countrywide, all these guys. We have changed that. Now, I think we have to do more at Fannie and Freddie, and I think that will happen. But I'll be honest with you, I checked with the realty community in Missouri and the bankers in Missouri, and they said the last thing we can do right now is dismantle Fannie and Freddie because of the real estate market, because of the role they have in the real estate market for providing funding for all of these different loans and securitization of all these different loans. But believe me, nobody out there is trying to take care of Fannie and Freddie, and I'm offended at the salaries they were making. I'm offended at the way they were run. And I think that if you give us a chance, once we get past this really rocky time, I think you'll see even more reforms of Fannie and Freddie. But the most important reform has been done. You can no longer sell a loan in the United States of America and not have skin in the game. And that's really the problem.
I'd also like a promise from you to vote as the Missouri people, the majority of Missouri people want you to vote from then on.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, I knew when I cast that vote it was unpopular. I've seen a lot of polls that show it about 50-50 in Missouri. I know this recent election it wasn't 50-50, but there have been a lot of polls that have shown it's about 50-50. I've also met a whole lot of people that are really against it, that when we sit down and talk about it, they say, you're right, I didn't know that was in there. Yeah, you're right, I didn't know that was in there. Yeah, well, I didn't know it was going to work that way. I think this woman that's here today, the small business, I think once she knows how it's really going to impact her business, she's going to be pleasantly surprised. And all I can tell you is that I can't poll every issue, and I can't make sure that every issue I'm voting on is going to go one way or the other. I can try to be forthright, and I was, and I have been through this whole process. I was told last year at this time, don't go out and do town halls. And I did almost 19 of them during the period of time that people were very upset. I've always been forthright that I believed we needed to fix the healthcare system. I think we have done a good job. Not the best job, not a perfect job, but I think we've done a good job and it will be better. I know that I may not get hired again. I knew that when I cast that vote. I knew the people of this state could very easily say, you know, we don't want you anymore because of the vote you cast. That's a risk I was willing to take. And I wish more people in Washington would take those kinds of risks. Because if more people would take those kinds of risks, I think we'd solve more problems. This can't be about just winning re-election. If we keep going down that road, our country's in a lot of trouble. So I don't mean to sound arrogant or that I know better. I don't. But I'm doing the very best job I can and being as forthright as I can. And I hope over time that even you decide maybe that health care bill's not as bad as you thought it was.
Happen.
Well, I have a feeling that's true. But if I'm making everybody happy, I'm not doing my job. So,
right.
Thank you all very, very much for being here. God bless you.